time. His mouth was so human against her own, and without meaning to, she breathed in his deepest dreaming and dreamed, right in that instant, that they were fated to be together. He pulled away, bewildered. Maybe he knew, could feel, that an unspoken contract had been signed, and with it, her magic had taken something from him. Or maybe he had no idea yet. It didn't matter anyway. She felt that first sparkle of guilt, the one that caused her to glance up. And then she gasped as she realized what had happened, as she saw what had been inevitable from the start. Malfleur, still in her travel cloak, entering the room, dropping a gift of glass which shattered like a scream. It would have been better if Malfleur too had screamed. Anything would have been better, Balcour thought, than the look on her perfectly sculpted face, its scar blazing white like a star, her cheekbones high and proud, her pretty mouth, thinner than her twins and more sharply defined, mute with comprehension. That moment, full of such ugliness and such beauty, became a thorn wedged permanently into Balcour's chest. She would never breathe again without feeling the pain of it. And still, there would be worse to come. Her vow never to love, her promise to shun Charles forever. The long months of begging for forgiveness, of being ignored over and over as Malfleur returned to her travels, leaving Balcour to feel as though one half of herself had died. The terror of watching her twin become darker, more remote, changed, until Belcur's only source of consolation was her dreams, which she had begun to collect and, using her magic, weave into elaborate tapestries where she would spend days trying to forget, 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 only to return from them panting, air racing into her lungs like angry hornets, filling her with the sting of the life she no longer wanted to live. She called this body of her greatest work, Sommeil. More time passed, and the wounds began to scar, the dreams a kind of salve, a salvation, really. They replaced her life, a prettier version of only the best times, while her waking existence took on the form of a blurred memory fading with each day. She had never used her magic so much as she used it then. It got so that she couldn't enter a room without sapping the power of dreaming from everyone in it. In the slither of twilight between waking and dreaming, she sometimes saw herself for what she had become, the type of fairy whom humans misunderstood, dreaded, abhorred. Some night she saw Charles again, despite her promise not to. But she couldn't say if any of these nights, and the agonizing ecstasies they contained, were real or imagined. There is no way to know now. Not after what happened. Not after. Balcour gags on smoke, the fumes strong in her nostrils. There's a scent of old things burning. Lace fire, flower fire, bone fire. This young woman, who struggles to free herself from her grasp, is a stranger, not her sister. Her sister has not come. And that's when the final piece of her abandoned life comes back to her. It was a short time later, less than a year after the incident, when Balcour began to notice a different kind of change. Her belly had grown round and hard, swirling with beginnings. The kick of a foot, the hiccup of tiny lungs. Some day soon, she realized, a child would be born. Desperate, she wrote to her sister, begging her to understand, begging her to forgive, so that Balcour might be free to love Charles again. Her wish came true when Malfleur responded. "Everyone deserves true love, my dear sister," she wrote. "And the child will know its father." Accompanying the letter was a magnificently carved chest, in and of itself one of the finest gifts her sister had ever sent her. With trembling hands, Balcour took the key that had been wrapped in the letter and used it to unlock the lid. The first thing she saw inside the trunk was a flash of gold, the peaks of the blackthorn crown Charles wore every day except when riding. Then she noticed the blood, and the meaning of her sister's words came crashing down like an axe. Balcour screamed now as she screamed then. yanking the oversized crown she has worn for over a century off her head and throwing it to the ground before the visitor. Her vision is blurred by tears over all she has lost. Her child, her sister, her love. For what she sees within the crown before her is the final memory, the final truth. Charles Blackthorne's severed head. 34. Isabel. Careful! William's voice flies up at her from below, rough and salty in the fog. The rope ladder sways under Isby's feet, banging against the craggy cliffside, and for one second she imagines what it would feel like to simply let go and allow the strait of sorrow, a few hundred feet below, to swallow her. She'd make just a small, unmemorable splash in the grand scheme of things. The image reminds her of a story Aurora once told her about an arrogant boy named Icarus, who fashioned a pair of waxen wings. He flew too close to the sun, which melted his wings. Then he fell to his death in the waters below. "Are you trying to make a point about the dangers of excessive pride?" Isby had asked, putting on a fake pout. "No," her sister had replied, tapping into her hand rapidly. "I'm making a point about wax." Isby swallows hard, trying to put the memories from her mind. She can't let herself give in to this urge to mourn her sister when she's not even dead. If she starts to grieve for Aurora, for Gil, for all of them, it will mean the end. She keeps climbing down, her hands slick on the rungs. The idea had come to her quickly. After the shock of seeing Aurora's unmoving form, they had ventured up to the war walks to survey the surrounding land. William saw animals asleep in the barn. He saw royal banners fallen under piles of muddy sleet and snow. He saw death. He saw the vines. And, in the distance, he saw something that made even the worst of the destruction seem but a prelude. The black wave of Malfleur's army descending Mount Briar to the west. Isby convinced him they needed to find some place to hide out while they came up with a new plan to lift the curse. Certainly it wasn't safe to stay put. The risk of disease was in the air, and the castle was unguarded. Nor was it wise to attempt further travel. Even the veiled road would be dangerous with Malfleur's organized forces now on the move. Time was ticking, and with every minute of daylight the threat of discovery grew. The idea to find some place upwind of the vines came first, and then the solution was natural, for there is only one thing separating the castle from the southerly winds that blow off the strait, and that's the cliff face. For years now they have housed the royal family's stores of wine, barrels and barrels of it, in caverns built directly into the sides of the cliffs. Apparently, the darkness and the temperature are ideal for preserving the wine's value. But they will also be ideal for eluding the dangerous fumes of the sleeping sickness and the detection of potential invaders. The rope ladder is tricky to handle, typically used only by experienced stewards of the royal household, or on rare occasions, the pantler or butler. The drop, if they should fall, is deadly. Next to the ladder dangles a series of pulleys and levers that convey the casks up and down as needed. The contraption clanks noisily beside Isby, rattling her nerves. William, who has gone before her, finally reaches out to help her into the entrance of the cavern. The blustery wind all around them drowns out her relieved sigh. She hears a scratchy snap of the flint, followed by the sizzle of the lantern being lit, and the bitter cold subsides somewhat as they make their way deeper into the wine room, especially once they hang the thick velvet curtain they brought and decide it's safe to remove their masks. Isby heaves in a huge breath, inhaling the cool musk of grapes and oaken casks. "Isabel," William touches her elbow, and she sucks in another breath. He still has that lime soap smell, or maybe she's only remembering it, that not quite sweetness. She turns to face him but takes a step back so that they are no longer touching. "You can call me Isby, you know. That's what Aurora and that's what everyone else calls me." She's not sure why she decided to tell him her nickname now, of all times. Maybe it's being home at last that's made her realize he needs to understand who she really is, her true role. She's the bastard, the trouble underfoot, the sister, the thorn. "No," he replies, and a little shock moves through her, A good kind of shock. I prefer to call you Isabel. It's who you are to me now. He's so resolute and so certain, even if he is contradicting her wishes. Maybe she doesn't mind. Maybe she's relieved, having come to savor the natural way her name rocks across his tongue and lips. Maybe even he's right. She's begun to think of herself that way too. All right then, she says, turning away to hide the heat in her cheeks. I was just going to unpack these. She gestures to the small bundle of scraps they managed to forage from the pantry, navigating around the cold, snoring bodies of the local peasants who had attempted to raid it before them. I think this should be enough to last a few days. A few days? How long do you intend for us to hide out here? There's urgency in his voice. Just until we can decide on another way to try lifting the curse. I'm thinking we need to get into contact with the fairy Duchess Violette, if we can find her. I remember Bink said,
Wait, William clears his throat. Listen, I want to keep you safe, to keep us safe. But what we need to do right now is mobilize our troops in order to protect the kingdoms. We need weapons and a military strategy, and we can't do any of that from a wine cave.
We can't do any of that anyway, unless we wake up Aurora and the council, Isabel counters, starting to feel exasperated. We need to lift the curse first.
There's no time for that. I agreed to come out here to the cliffs with you so we could strategize, not stick our heads in the sand. And yes, Isabel, before you interrupt me, we can do it without lifting the curse.
William's hands are on her shoulders. This time, she doesn't pull away. How? She asks.
Simple. You authorize the Delusian troops to gather in my kingdom and receive my weapons. You coordinate the safe transfer of oil to Arbin while I send word to the chief of military back home to prepare for battle. We issue masks to anyone who needs to come within an unsafe proximity to the palace. Don't you see? We don't need your sister for any of it. Right now, all we need is information we can easily dig up around the castle. Supply stores and trade routes and...
So you're saying we should just leave Aurora as she is? Asleep? Forever?
I'm saying that right now you may have to choose.
He steps closer to her, still touching her.
You can try saving your sister, or you can try saving your kingdom. Neither are guarantees, but it has to be one or the other. We're at the end, Isabel, and I need to know where you stand.
The smell of wine in the room is so strong. It must be, for it is making her feel hot, intoxicated, fuzzy. Choose? But she can't choose. That's not fair. That's not in her power. And, he goes on, stepping even closer until she can feel the heat of his body just a few fingers' breadth from her own.
If we must make the alliance official,
his hands slide down her arms. He kneels before her.
Then accept me as your prince and rule by my side.
His words are the crest of a tidal wave, and she stands there in disbelief as it torrents on.
You've shown you can do it, through your bravery, your cleverness, your determination. Some might call it stubbornness.
She almost laughs. But she doesn't. She can't make a sound, can't stop the wave that is still barreling toward her.
You are the type of ruler who might actually inspire the people to listen. I want to do this together. With you. Marry me.
The wave crashes. Silence.
Marry me, Isabel,
he repeats. The dazzling, shocking aftermath, lighter than air. The foam. But I can't.
You can, he says. The question is, will you?
She's too dizzy to stand. She can't quite believe this is happening. He's proposing.
Again.
She gets down onto her knees as well, and he lets go of her hand so she can touch his face, the firm ridge of his cheeks, the softness of his mouth, the emotion, the hunger buzzing through his skin. William, what to say, how to tell him, how to...
Isabel,
he whispers. He insists. Now his hands are on her face, on her lips, on her jaw, tilting her back slightly so that her neck is arched. Time seems to stop, and Isabel remembers being a child, no more than two, watching a white feather float from a down coverlet a maid was shaking out. It fell so slowly, idling back and forth on the air. She felt sure it would never land. And then all at once, she is no longer a child, and no longer waiting. It is late. William is asleep beside her, what remains of his torn cloak forming a thick, soft blanket beneath them. It's a normal kind of sleep, not the sickness. She made sure to test it by waking him repeatedly until finally he growled half-teasingly and kissed her until he succeeded in convincing her to stop. Now she lies awake in the darkness, touching the corner of her mouth where his first kiss landed, his lips merely brushing hers, remembering how quickly things unspooled from there, and then his lips were parting hers, and his hand was at the small of her back, pulling her up against him, and she was kissing him back. And it was different than her first kiss with Gilbert, which was wild and unexpected, clumsy and exciting, and messy and sweet, like a day in the fields with freckles, flying across the open grass, the wind tangling her hair. Escape. With William, everything was the opposite. Slow, deliberate, full of meaning. She had never felt more present in her own skin, every touch like a raindrop in a pond, rippling outward from a single spot. But now, she can't sleep. She's afraid that if she does, this will all go away, and she'll lose what it felt like to be beautiful, to be chosen. That if she sleeps, she will dream, and in that dream she will hear her mother singing, and the song will lure her to stay asleep forever, where it's safe, or else worse, that waking from it will shatter her. Wind whistles along the craggy cliffs, the mouth of the strait sloshes below, and she knows she has to make a decision. William has asked her to marry him, and although she said yes with every part of her, she did not actually say it. She sits up, letting his arm slide gradually off her, and pulls on her cloak. She fumbles along the floor until she finds her mask, discarded several paces away. Then, quietly, she pushes back the thick velvet curtain and moves along the row of wine casks, barrel by barrel, counting them. By 48, she has reached the lip of the cave, and though it's the most foolish, willful thing she's done in a list of very foolish and willful things, she reaches for the ladder and climbs. She's drawn back to Aurora's bedside as if she were sleepwalking, as if some external force has guided her there instead of the plain fact that she knows her way. Knows it in her bones and in her hair and in her fingertips. She will always know her way around this castle, and she will always come back to her sister, because Aurora is intrinsic to Isabel. She is the truest part of Isabel. She is her heart. She kneels as she did before William just hours ago, and once again takes her sister's hands. "Please," she whispers. Aurora's chest softly rises and falls, rises and falls. In the quiet, Isabel can almost hear Aurora's strange, unabashed laugh, but she has the forlorn impression that Aurora is not here, that this Aurora is but a snow sculpture they've made, and some detail, as yet undetected, is out of place. It scares her almost, this other Aurora in the place of her real sister, who is gone. She leans down and puts her lips to Aurora's cool forehead and kisses it, like she would sometimes do when they were little, on nights when stories of the plague frightened them, when they could hear the hacking coughs of the sick through the walls and knew that come morning, another maid or groom would be carried away from the palace on a plank, a faceless form beneath a thin white sheet. And then, they learned later, when they were older, the body would be burned in a massive fire before being thrown into a shared grave. On nights like those, Aurora would whimper and cling to Isabel, and Isabel felt braver because of it. But now she feels more alone than ever, even after everything that just happened between her and William, maybe because of it, and because she still can't stop thinking about the fact that she doesn't know whether Gilbert is dead or alive, and that it may be her fault if he's dead, and that she doesn't know what she wants, other than this one thing, for Aurora to wake up. "Please," she whispers again, her voice cracking. She's come so far, she's tried so hard, and it hasn't been enough. Maybe all along, she knew it wouldn't be. Maybe all of this, her entire journey, has been a terrible, beautiful distraction from what she knew deep down she must do. Let Aurora go. She can't remember the last time she wept,
But the tears come now, haltingly, and then hard, wetting her face and rattling her whole body, causing her to gasp. She feels out of control, like a laundered garment pulled loose by the wind and flying off the line, flailing over the sides of the cliffs. She can't stop. Tears drip from her cheeks and fall onto Aurora's pillow and onto her closed eyes. Isabel cries quietly and fully, solitude, a weight crushing down on her. Isabel cries, and Aurora sleeps. She's not sure how much time has passed. All she knows is that she can't cry anymore. She takes a deep, shuddering breath.
"We're at the end," William said to her. "I need to know where you stand."
Isabel pushes to her feet. There are still so many questions she doesn't have answers for. Who to love? Who her own mother is? She doesn't know what she wants, doesn't know how to save her sister, doesn't know how to live without her. But she knows now what she must do. She must say yes. 35. Aurora. A deep, breathless blackness pulses within her and around her, clogging her lungs.
"Let go of me!"
Aurora screams, trying to wrench her dress from the Queen's desperate clutch.
"I am not who you thought!"
Her words twist strangely into the air, mingling with the smoke blurring her vision. After all, she isn't who she thought she was either. She had been a damsel like those in the stories she'd read all her life, waiting to be rescued. Her lack of touch had not only protected her from feeling pain, but also from understanding its purpose. The white hair of the Queen flickers as Aurora finally yanks herself free and runs toward a window, heaving it open. But the outside is just as dark as the inside, and even in the heat and smoke, she feels the great power of Sommeil embracing her. Its desire, its denial. Through that tenebrosity of want, she sees leaping flames, gathered shadows, voices, many of them, are shouting. Thin silhouettes running, tripping over one another, some holding long poles, pitchforks, spears, fleeing, screaming. Ashes blow through the sky, a black cloud spreading toward the castle from the wall. The borderlands are on fire. No one can get out. They will all die. Aurora says, momentarily hypnotized, as in one quick breath the hunger of the fire blooms and spreads. Then she is once again scrambling through the darkness of the castle's twisting passages, punctuated only by the hot flash of the flames. She has lost Wren. She has lost the Queen. Lost herself. The ashes spread as the fire beyond the wall grows. It is hot, too hot. She can't think. Her hands have gone numb. It feels as though her very voice is burning away inside her throat. She coughs, she chokes, she falls. And then she feels cold metal against her palm. She realizes her eyes were clenched against the smoke, but she forces herself to part them. They sting and water as she examines the object in her hand. It's Belcur's crown. It is large, though the size of a man's head, not a woman's. Because, Aurora realizes quickly, the Queen has been wearing Charles Blackthorne's crown for all these years. And it isn't burning. It isn't even hot, but blissfully cool. Of course. Because it is an object from the real world. It's immune to the power of Sommeil. Immune even to the Queen's magical fire. She feels how heavy the crown is in her hands. There's something engraved on the inside. She squints. True love. It says. With her hand on the gold crown, she begins to breathe a little easier. The crown, she realizes, can save her. She just needs to think clearly, figure out how to save the rest of the people. She can't think in this heat, in this smoke. She can see she has made it down to the first floor. Through the windows, people are still screaming, frenzied, racing through the grounds, attempting to break free. The sun is still rising. The castle is still burning. She places the crown on her head. The heat disappears, and she is able to gasp, sucking in fresh air. Life. Life. She is going to live. She has saved herself, and she will save the others, too. The light is so bright, it is blazing, blinding.
Aurora blinks, still gulping, still shaking as the flames release her. Once, twice, and again. The third time she opens her eyes, she figures out what has happened. She has awoken.
This is Fiona Hardingham. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Spindlefire by Lexa Hillier. This program was produced by Common Mode. Paul Foley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2017 by Lexa Hillier. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.